Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon, generally speaking. That would include today, but it will not include tomorrow. Tomorrow's New Year's Day, and radio station staff that help produce the program will be having the day off, and therefore we will not be having a live broadcast tomorrow, but we will today, Lord willing, if we make it through the next hour. And I have no reason to doubt that that will happen. So, if you'd like to be on the program, you may have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to ask. You might have a different view from the host you'd like to bring up to discuss. You may want to just give me a call and tell me what God's telling you to do for the next year coming up, how you're going to change your life. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today is Chad calling from Nooksack, Washington. Chad, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
That's great. Say, I wanted to get your insight reconciling a couple passages.
Okay.
The first one being Matthew 6:33. Seeking God's kingdom first, and all these things will be added unto you. And then going over to 1 Corinthians 4, verse 11, where Paul says, even to the present hour we both hunger and thirst and are poorly clothed and beaten and homeless. And how do we reconcile those couple of things there?
Well, we do it by recognizing what really constitutes a need and what does not. You know, Paul said to Timothy, having food and clothing, we will with these things be content, in chapter 6, verse 8. And even though he said in 1 Corinthians that he was hungry and he was naked at times, he never had less than he needed to stay alive. That's the important thing. If you're alive, then God has, up to this moment, supplied everything you need to be alive. You may not have as much food as you sometimes would like or clothing, but If you're not dead from exposure and you're not starved to death, then so far your needs have been met. The day you starve to death will be the day that you haven't had enough food. So Paul had a very low standard of living. Remember when he was in jail in Rome and he wrote the Philippian epistle, he told the Philippians that he had learned to be abased or to abound, to be in want or to have abundance. But then he went on to say that he had abundance at that very time when he was writing, yet he was in prison. He considered his condition in prison to be, even though it was a third world jail, as we would call it, he was living in abundance because he had enough to eat. And it was probably crusty bread, but it was still something to keep him alive. So he said that he had learned to be content in all things. And that's the secret. Now, when Jesus said that the birds of the air are fed by God, and that the flowers are clothed by God, then he says, if you seek first the kingdom of God, all these things will be added to you. I think what he's saying is you'll have everything you need for your survival given to you, as long as you're supposed to survive, of course. The time will come where each of us has a time to die, and God is not obligated to keep us alive infinitely. You know, I mean, on this world, we have a time to go. And while God has use for us in this world, he'll supply all our needs. And that's what Jesus is saying. All the things we need, things that people usually worry about, we don't need to worry about because God will supply our needs as we seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Now, someone says, well, I was trusting God and, he didn't provide my needs. Well, I wonder how it is they're speaking to me if they say that. You know, their needs must have been met or else they wouldn't be speaking. And they might say, well, I got put out of my home. Well, Paul may not have had a home at times either, like he said in the passage you mentioned. Even Jesus said, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So even being homeless is not an example of God not providing, because even Jesus was homeless and Paul was homeless. And there are Christians today who are homeless. I know some. But as long as we're alive, God has provided for our needs up to this day. If we die tomorrow of starvation, then God stopped providing, we'd have to assume, for the very reason that he intended to take us home. Even when he said he took care of the birds, they die too. God takes care of the birds as long as he wants them alive. The issue here is to recognize the will of God. When Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, the idea here is I'm not seeking my things, I'm seeking God's will in everything. And as I seek for God's will, that means if he wants me to live, I want to live. If he wants me to die, I want to die. If he wants me to be rich, I want to be rich. If he wants me to be poor, then I want to be poor. The point is, none of us who's no one listening to my voice right now can say they haven't had everything provided that they've needed, even if they're uncomfortable and hungry. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't help them. We should. But the point I'm making is when I'm hungry and when I'm cold and when I've been very poor much of my life, I'm not so poor right now, but I've spent many decades truly in poverty. I never thought that God hadn't supplied all my needs, because I interpret needs the way Paul did, having enough food to stay alive, having enough clothing to keep me alive. That's with these things we'll be content. So I think we just have to recognize that Paul had a very low standard of living that he was willing to accept as normative. And frankly, he said that we should be prepared to do so too.
Okay. That makes sense. And my other question was about meat sacrificed to idols. We're in a Revelation, the first few chapters, it makes mention of that.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul says it's pretty much nothing. It's not a big deal. It's not
right.
A problem. How do we reconcile those couple of things?
Well, Paul said if it's not a big deal to you, it's not to God. But to many people, he said it is a big deal. And those people who for whom it is a big deal, they shouldn't do it. In Revelation chapter 2, we read that there were those who taught the doctrine of Balaam, telling people to eat meat sacrificed to idols and commit fornication. And there were those in another church where Jezebel was teaching those same things, to eat meat sacrificed to idols and commit fornication. Obviously, these are examples of people teaching that it's okay to practice idolatry and be involved in the temple prostitutes. That's what fornication would be referring to. There was a great temptation in the Greek and Roman world for Christians to participate in the idolatrous festivals, because that was not only their past religion, it was also their whole culture of the world around them. And it was where people socialized. And so to participate in the idolatrous feasts was a great temptation. But Paul said, you know, if you eat meat sacrificed to idols that you buy in the marketplace, it's not a big deal. But you don't want to go into idol temples and participate in idolatry. He said you can't eat at the table of the Lord and the table of the devil too. And that's what he said you'd be doing if you go into idolatrous feasts. So Paul too, like Jesus in Revelation, was saying Christians should not, you know, participate in idolatry. But he was saying if you accidentally eat meat sacrificed to idols, and it's no big thing, it doesn't have to be a big thing to God either. It isn't a big thing to God. What God's looking at is the heart. And eating meat sacrificed to idols was usually done at a festival in honor of an idol. And therefore, Christians would have no reason to be there, no valid reason to be there. And anyone who's telling the Christians they can go ahead and participate in the idolatrous feast, like Jezebel was in Revelation 2, would be getting them to compromise, you know, with idolatry. Paul didn't ever say it was okay to compromise with idolatry. He just said that the meat that sacrificed idols isn't magical or cursed or anything like that. So if you happen to eat at somebody's house, you don't have to worry about whether they're feeding you meat that's a remnant of an animal sacrificed to an idol. Or if you're buying meat in the market, he said, you don't have to ask whether it's sacrificed to an idol, because it's not important. But what is important is your heart. And why would anyone go into an idolatrous temple and sleep with the priestesses there unless they were participating in idolatry? Christians aren't allowed to do that.
So when he says in 1 Corinthians 8, verses 10, he says, for if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? So I take from that it was okay as long as the heart was right to go into a temple?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think Paul was saying there were some Christians thinking that they had the liberty to do that. And he said, well, what's that going to do to your brother who's going to, you might think it's no big thing to you, but it, you know, it's going to make other people think it's okay, and it'll be a big thing to them. So stay away from it.
Okay.
The point I think Paul would make, and Jesus, if you sat them down in the same room and asked them on this subject, and I think that they're, the sayings of Jesus and the sayings of Paul both would have the same interpretation, that if you are, you know, celebrating an idol, then you're out of line as a Christian. If you're eating meat just as meat, and it's and the fact that it may or may not have been sacrificed to an idol is of no issue to you. You don't believe in idols anyway and don't care about them. Then what you eat is not going to hurt you. It's what's in your heart toward the thing. And that's what he pointed out. He said, not everyone has the knowledge that an idol is nothing at all. Some Christians knew that an idol is nothing, and so if meat was sacrificed to an idol, it wasn't contaminated thereby. But other people didn't know that. Many people felt like the idol was a real thing. And so it's what's in your heart when you eat the meat that matters. Now, Paul did argue that people shouldn't go into idol temples. There may have been some Christians who were doing it because they were saying, hey, we have the liberty to do this. And Paul was saying, hey, well, you may think you have the liberty, but it's going to stumble all your brothers, so don't do it.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering those questions. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your ministry, Steve.
Okay, Chad, thanks for your call. I appreciate it very much. Daniel from Seattle, Washington is next. Daniel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, I just want to tell you again, like the other brother said, man, I really, really appreciate your program and your ministry.
Thank you.
Actually, there's a personal question, and then there's a scriptural Bible question. So I'm up here in Seattle, and just want to know if you plan on coming back to the Monroe area anytime soon.
I am coming to Monroe in or up to that area in February to speak for Youth with a Mission, and I will probably be lining up other speaking appointments in the area while I'm up there. And I can tell you right now, I'm going to be there February 18th through the 20th for Youth with a Mission. If somebody wants to set up, you know, meetings anytime that week, they can get in touch with me and we'll do it.
Okay. Well, great. Always been meaning to try to catch one of your seminars, but haven't been able to do that. Want to meet you in person.
Yeah.
So here's the Bible question, Revelation 21, talking about the New Jerusalem. And I believe I'm going to say this correctly, but it talks about the new heaven coming out of a new heaven and a new earth. Saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride. So here's my question for you, Steve, and I'll take the rest of the answer off the air. So is that a literal statement or is it hype? Hyperbole, I think that's the word I want to use.
All right. I'll be glad to address that.
Okay. Thank you, brother. God bless you.
Okay, Daniel. Thank you. I don't think hyperbole is the word you're thinking of. You're probably just wondering, is it spiritual or not? Hyperbole would specifically mean an intentional exaggeration for emphasis. But in this case, I think your question would be, is this a literal city coming literally down from heaven to earth, the new earth? Or is this a spiritual thing? Is this a spiritual reality that it's talking about? That's what I'm assuming you're wondering, because those would be the two apparent options. I believe both, frankly. I believe that just as the tabernacle that Moses built was a literal building, but that it had spiritual significance. All the details of the tabernacle represented spiritual things. I think the New Jerusalem is that way too. I think it's a literal city, but the description of it in Revelation, I think, has spiritual significance. And it is, I believe that the New Jerusalem is nothing else but the church, but I believe it is the church in its glorified form. When the Lord returns, we will be caught to meet the Lord in the air, we'll be glorified, and we'll return. And I think it's the return of the believers at the time of the coming of Christ that is here seen as the New Jerusalem descending out of heaven, having the glory of God, it says. So it's the church glorious. Now, one reason I say it's the church is because there are other passages that refer to the New Jerusalem and identify it with the church, in fact. For example, in Hebrews chapter 12, the writer of Hebrews tells us in verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. So we have come, he says, to the church, which he refers to as the Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You might remember in Matthew chapter 6 or 5, Matthew 5, Jesus told his disciples, you are the light of the world, a city set on a hill that cannot be hid. So we are a city. We're the new Jerusalem. The church corporately is the heavenly Jerusalem, the writer of Hebrews said. Galatians chapter 4 also makes reference to this. Paul says in Galatians 4:26, the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. That is of us all as Christians. Now, the mother of the Christians is the church. The church is God's wife, Christ's bride. And therefore, we as God's children are brought into his family through the agency of the church. And Paul is referring to the church when he talks about the Jerusalem that is above, that's the mother of us all. Now, when you look at the description of the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21, you find, for example, it has 12 foundations. And on each stone of the foundation, there's the name of one of the 12 apostles. So the city is built on the foundation of the apostles. Well, Paul said in Ephesians chapter 2 that the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. And you find as you read the description that it does have spiritual relevance to the church, so much so that there's a whole school of thought that teaches that this vision of the New Jerusalem is not a future vision of a literal New Jerusalem at all, but it's simply a spiritual description of the church in figurative form. But as I said, I believe it's literal also. I believe it is the church, but I think it's the church glorified after the second coming of Christ. And so I take it literally, well, more or less literally. At least I believe there's a literal city. I don't know to what degree any of the language of description may be figurative, but I believe there is a literal New Jerusalem that comes down out of the heavens to the new earth at the coming of Christ, as well as seeing in it the spiritual lessons that you are alluding to. Let's talk to, looks like, this is a hard one to read because the writing is so small. It looks like Oleg from Seattle, and that would be our third call in a row from Washington State. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
Good.
Good. So my question would be, I have my wife's side of the family. Some of them became Seventh-day Adventists.
Uh-huh.
And question would be two-part. Is it something that a just different, simply denomination of a Protestant belief, or is it something that as a Holy Spirit filled Christian, I should stand against and point out, I believe, some clear issues with that systematic belief or denomination? Or should I let it go and let Holy Spirit work in them the way he does?
Well, you're not likely to get very far if you make it your goal to change their mind, although it wouldn't hurt to be able to dialogue with them about some of the differences they have, because they, depending on how connected they are, the Seventh-day Adventists are a Christian group, but they have some distinctives. They have some distinctives that other Christian groups don't generally have. The main issue with them is that they are followers of a particular person named Ellen G. White. And many of them view her as a prophetess. I've been told by Seventh-day Adventists that she didn't call herself a prophetess, but many of them view her as a prophetess, as one who restored, you know, the Sabbath observance to the church in the last days. And, I don't agree with them about the Sabbath observance. I don't agree with them about the dietary restrictions. I certainly don't agree with them about the mark of the beast being worshiping on Sunday. And I don't agree with them on the investigatory judgment, or whatever they call it. Frankly, I don't follow Ellen G. White's teaching. I don't believe that she's, I don't believe she was any kind of a prophetess. Now, I believe she made mistakes. I think she probably was a Christian. I don't have any reason to want to say she was not a Christian. And I know the Seventh-day Adventist people I know, I believe, are true Christians. But just as in any church, people can become more or less loyal to the distinctives of their group when they should be only loyal to Christ. And so when you join a group that's got certain distinctives and you're real enthusiastic about that group, then you hold on to those distinctives really tightly, because that's what really basically defines you as a member of that group. You can't be a Seventh-day Adventist if you're not a believer in the Sabbath. You can't be a Seventh-day Adventist if you don't hold to the distinctives of their group. And so, because most Christians don't hold to the distinctives of their groups, they're not Seventh-day Adventists. The ones who are there because they do want to hold to the distinctives of that group, and it becomes very difficult to persuade them otherwise. I've got Seventh-day Adventist friends I've had dialogues with for over a decade, and to me, their arguments about the Sabbath are very flawed. I've pointed out to them, as I would think clearly enough for most ordinary Christians to see, that the Sabbath, as they're interpreting it, is not what the New Testament is teaching. As an obligation, it's not an obligation for Christians. Yet they don't. It's like water off a duck's back. There are many people in certain groups, whether they're Catholic, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, or they could be Presbyterian or Baptist or Pentecostal or Seventh-day Adventist. People in different groups sometimes are more devoted to their group than to truth. Of course, they believe their group is the truth or has the truth. But the point is, a person who's devoted to the truth will want to cross-examine the views even of the group that they believe correctly with, or that they believe is correct. They'll want to cross-examine because they want truth more than they want belonging. And when a person really wants the truth, they can find their way through an organization like that. They can even worship there and not necessarily accept all the things that that the group holds to. But I wouldn't recommend it, because there's not very much to set a Seventh-day Adventist church apart from other churches, except the parts that I disagree with and which I think are a misunderstanding of the New Testament on their part. That doesn't mean they're not Christians. It doesn't mean that if your wife's family is Seventh-day Adventist that I think badly of them. It just means that it's not a church I would want to join because of the particular distinctives that they hold to that I don't agree with.
And then can I add, do we have time if I can add a follow-up question to that?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Is that okay? So then their main focus, like you said, would be that the mark of the beast or Antichrist is going to come out from a Catholic church and it's on Sunday or whatnot. The question would be, why do we, or when did the church started to have services on Sunday itself and not Saturday? When did the distinction happen between Sabbath and Sunday?
Well, we don't have any record in the Bible at all of the church holding meetings on the Sabbath. The Sabbath is Saturday, and throughout the book of Acts, Saturday is recognized as the Sabbath. For example, every time it says, Paul went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Well, that was Saturday, okay? So Sabbath, in the book of Acts, as in the Old Testament, the Sabbath is recognized to be Saturday. But we don't read of the church keeping the Sabbath. We never read of Paul keeping the Sabbath or of Jesus keeping the Sabbath. Sometimes Seventh-day Adventists say that they kept the Sabbath because we read of them going into the synagogue. But they went there to preach, which was their work. They were working on the Sabbath. They weren't keeping the Sabbath. They were like priests. They were like priests in the temple who work on the Sabbath. This is not keeping the Sabbath. This is, Jesus said, the priests profane the Sabbath day every Sabbath, and they're guiltless. Yeah. Why? Because they work on the Sabbath. And keeping the Sabbath means you don't do work on the Sabbath. Jesus did his same work on the Sabbath as any other day, and he was accused of breaking Sabbath because of it. But he said, well, my Father does this, so I do it. Paul also preached every day of the week, including Sabbath, and the place he'd find people, Jews to preach to, would be in the synagogue, so he went there. But we have no record of the early church keeping the Sabbath. Now, as far as meeting on Sunday is concerned, we only read of one meeting on Sunday after Pentecost in the book of Acts, and that's when Paul was traveling through Tyre, and they held some meetings for him to preach because he was leaving the next day, and they said it was the first day of the week, which would be Sunday. They held a meeting to break bread and to hear Paul preach. We don't know if they met every Sunday or if they were just meeting that particular Sunday because Paul was leaving the next day. We don't have any record in the New Testament of Christians holding regular meetings on Sabbath or on Sunday. Now, when you get to the second and third century, we do have Sunday meetings. Justin Martyr describes a Christian service, and he said, on the day that is named after the sun, we gather, which was the first day of the week. And so in the days of Justin Martyr, which was a long time before there was a pope, the Christians were meeting on Sunday. They didn't call it the Sabbath, though. They didn't call it the Sabbath. The early church fathers mentioned that they don't have to keep the Sabbath. That's the Old Testament is keeping the Sabbath. Yeah, but they did worship on Sunday. But in the book of Acts, they tended to worship any day they wanted to. In fact, they met daily from house to house. So there was never any indication in the New Testament that Christians ever regarded the Sabbath as an obligation for them to keep.
Right, and so the earliest account, historical account, would be that about the second century or 200 years after Christ,
couple hundred years after.
Sunday.
Yeah.
I see.
But you see, there were no popes. Sometimes they say that Constantine changed, Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. I don't know if he ever said anything about that or not, but if he did, that's still, 150 years after the church was already meeting on Sundays. They just weren't calling it the Sabbath. And popes have referred to Sunday as the Sabbath, but they're wrong to do so. The Bible doesn't refer to Sunday as the Sabbath anywhere.
That makes sense. Perfect. Hey, thank you so much. God bless, and Happy New Year to you.
All right, same to you, brother. Thank you for your call. All right, our next caller is Ron from West Hills, California. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Steve. Before I ask my question, are you still broadcasting in Albuquerque on a station?
At the moment, we still have that station going, yes.
What station is that?
You know what? I'd have to look at our website to find that out.
Okay, that's fine, because I didn't see it on the website. Challenge you have up through the 31st of next January, is that just for these new stations, or is that for all stations, the matching challenge, or do
that
we have to designate?
That matching challenge is really just for those new stations.
Okay.
Not all new stations. So Phoenix station and the Sacramento station.
But those are the ones that need it. Okay.
Yeah, but they are the ones that are the most deficient in their support. You probably listen on KBRT more often.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah, and KBRT, we're doing much better in KBRT than we are in some of these other areas.
Okay, so if we contribute to that, we're just really trying to help those other stations out with a matching.
Well, right. If you want the gift to be matched, yes, you should designate on any check you give, this is for Sacramento or for Phoenix.
Yes.
But if you just give to the Narrow Path in general, it won't be matched if you're writing from Southern California, but it'll still help.
Well, yeah, you just have to designate with.
Yeah.
Okay. My question is really going to be a very simple question. I see you had the lecture series, What Are We to Make of Israel? And I haven't listened to it yet, but I just want a simple answer from you, because I'm not trying to get into dispensationalism or what their opinions are. What is your opinion of the nation of Israel coming into existence? Do you think it was just a coincidence, or do you think it was just part of the way the world is going, and other than what the dispensationalists say? What would your personal opinion be about that?
Well, I don't know to what degree God had a hand in it, because God is involved in everything in the world. I believe, for example, that the founding of America, I think God had a hand in that. I think, in Charles Martel defeating the Muslims, I think God had a hand in that. And so also with the founding of Israel, someone could say God had a hand in it, and I wouldn't necessarily have any problem with that. But I don't believe that it's necessarily a fulfillment of any prophecy. Now, some people say it is, of course, but I don't think there's any prophecies in the Bible that can be shown to refer to it. And I'm familiar with all the prophecies in the Bible, I guarantee you. And I don't know of any of them that refer to a modern-day state of Israel. Now, I would also say that the modern-day state of Israel came about not through godly influence. That is, Zionism is the movement that began in the 1890s, which was pushing for the Jews to return to their homeland and to receive British and international support of that land being given to Israel. It was the Zionist movement. And that was not started by a believing Jew at all. He was a secular Jew. He wasn't even an observant Jew. He was just he just had political and secular interest in Israel having a land. And of course, after World War II, there was a stronger international interest in that because of the Holocaust and sympathy, of course, for the Jews who had been vulnerable throughout the ages to persecution from lands that they lived in. So there was a much more of an international interest in the idea of giving them some land. The problem is the giving of the land to Israel by Britain and by the UN mandate was the idea, you know, the land was already belonged to somebody. There were people who had been living there for over 1,000 years, and they naturally thought of it as their own land, just like the Native Americans thought North America was their land when we showed up. And you can reasonably see why they would. They'd been here for hundreds of years and had, you know, the hegemony of the land. And then Britain makes, you know, the Balfour Declaration, and then the UN mandate, you know, authorizes that Israel gets, you know, more than half the land that belonged to the Palestinians. And this caused friction. And unfortunately, in the friction that came afterwards, there were atrocities done by both the Palestinians and the Israeli militias and paramilitary groups like Irgun and such. So we have you know, atrocities that were done in the establishment of the nation of Israel. One could say, well, so did they when they, you know, when Joshua conquered the Promised Land, they were atrocities against the Canaanites. Well, that's true, but we have specific mandate from God for them to take the land from the Canaanites. We don't have any mandate from God for them to go in and wipe out the Palestinians, who were, as far as we know, just, you know, minding their own business, taking care of their farms. And Israel came in and drove many of them, about 700,000 of them, out of their towns and out of their farms into refugee camps. It's not very good treatment. And it wasn't motivated by godly concerns. The leaders of the Zionist movement were not godly Jews. They were politically minded Jews. It's true, Christians are often Zionists for biblical reasons, as they would see it. And therefore, when Christians are Zionists, they usually think of it as a religious motivated movement. And, you know, among Christians, if they are Zionists, it usually is religiously motivated. But among Jews, a great number of religious Jews don't believe in Zionism. They believe that they should show justice to the Palestinians, like God said Israel should do, treat, you know, not abuse the stranger in their land. So there's a lot there to be double-minded about. You know, I don't see it as a fulfillment of any prophecy, and I don't see it as something that was done initially through godly influenced people, and I don't see it done in a godly way. It's strictly a mandate of the United Nations gave them the land. And then even before the mandate took effect, many Jewish paramilitary groups in the land were going and wiping out Palestinian villages of men, women, and children, just lining up and shooting them. And that's continued to happen. Now, I'm not saying the Palestinians didn't do their share of bad things. They did. Both sides have been very bloody and very unjust. But we sometimes only hear, you know, a rather sugar-coated side of the story about Israel. And you know, Christians really, before they say anything about it, they ought to look things up. They ought to find out something about the history before they say, I'm for it. Because, I mean, if I was a German Christian who had never read any of the history of the Holocaust, and I just thought, well, you know, Germany über alles, you know, Hitler's a great guy, what he did. Well, no, he wasn't a great guy. If you find out what he actually did, he wasn't good at all. He was evil. And you'll find this to be often true of people that we might think of as heroes because they were military and paramilitary heroes in the founding of Israel for Zionism. But when you find out what they did and what they said about it, they were ruthless in many cases. Not all of them. I mean, there's good Israelis and there's bad ones. There's good Palestinians and there's bad ones. The thing is that if someone says, well, what do you think about the modern state of Israel? I think, well, that's a very nuanced question because there's more than one side to the story. And the real question is there some reason that we should approve of atrocities done by Israel because of some perception we have that they're fulfilling Bible prophecy? I don't see which prophecies they would be fulfilling. If someone wants to call me and point them out to me, they can. But I would just say that I'm not against anyone having a homeland, but I am against people doing atrocities. And I don't think either Israel or Palestine should be established on atrocities.
Okay, well, thank you for that very thorough perspective. I appreciate it.
All right, Ron. God bless you.
Okay, and God bless you too, Steve.
Bye now. Jonathan from Concord, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have been listening to your lectures on Calvinism, or some of them, and like you, I'm a non-Calvinist. But I've just been curious, what's your take on how widespread Calvinism is within today's Christian church? Is it dominating or not so much, or does it tend to stick along denominational lines, or what does that look like to you?
Yeah, well, five-point Calvinism usually sticks along denominational lines. You're going to find that the Reformed churches, Presbyterian, and other Reformed groups that have their roots in the Reformation and especially in John Calvin's Reformation, are going to be five-point Calvinists for the most part. Now, there's going to be other groups, a lot of them, that aren't in Reformed theology, but have imbibed Calvinist ideas without calling them that, without knowing they're that. For example, I was raised Baptist. Most Baptists are not Calvinists, though some are. There are denominations called Reformed Baptist, and they are Baptists that are five-point Calvinists. People like James White and John Piper and so forth would belong to that category. They're Reformed Baptist. So they are five-point Calvinists. But most Baptist groups are not five-point Calvinists. The Baptist group I was raised in, at least the Baptist beliefs I had growing up, were not Calvinistic at all, but we would have thought they were partly Calvinistic. We would have called it three-point Calvinism, perhaps. But there is no such thing as three-point Calvinism. If you don't hold all 5 points, you don't hold any of them, or at least you don't hold any of them consistently. Because if you actually understand the 5 points, each of them hinges on the others. They are really pretty much seamlessly required by the logic of accepting any one of them. They kind of inform each other. When people think they are three-point Calvinists, then the 3 points they think they believe, they are misunderstanding. They don't understand what Calvinism teaches about them. For example, I used to think, growing up as a Baptist and believing in once saved, always saved, I figured that was a Calvinist doctrine. I believed in once saved, always saved. But the church, whenever they explained it, they explained it very differently than Calvinists do. Calvinists believe in perseverance of the saints. They believe if you're really one of the elect, you will persevere in the faith. But the way I was understanding it, or misunderstanding it from my denomination, was that if you accept Christ at some time in your life, even if you don't persevere in the faith, you're still saved. Even if you go back to live in the world and are an unbeliever. You know, you just kind of, you get that salvation thing sticks to you like, you know, white glue, and you just can't get rid of it no matter how much you want to. Calvinists wouldn't believe that. Calvinists would believe that if you actually depart from the faith, then you weren't one of the elect in the first place. So there's different, there are groups that have some influence of Calvinism, but don't, in many cases don't understand the points properly, and they would think of themselves as partial Calvinists. Some people have called themselves Calminians, trying to mix Calvinist with Arminian, but you can't be a Calminian. I mean, the 5 points of Calvinist are simply denials of the 5 points of Arminianism. You can't hold them both. The two systems are mutually exclusive. Now, how widespread is it? Well, it's growing, and it's growing especially among young intellectuals. The young, restless, and reformed, they call themselves. You know, they're they're maybe college students, university students, who think Calvinism is intellectually satisfying. It's certainly not very spiritually satisfying, in my opinion, but it may be intellectually satisfying to those who are willing to turn their religion into a system of propositions that are logical, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if God is simply a combination of propositions you make about God, Calvinism would not be objectionable. It would simply be an intellectually engaging philosophy. But the problem is that if God is in fact the God of the Calvinists, if there's a real God and he's not just, you know, the result of propositions, then if he's very much like the God of the Calvinists, he's not a very good God. And he doesn't seem to be the God that Jesus talked about or exhibited.
Yeah.
You know, so in my opinion, Calvinism has an intellectual appeal, but you know, it's not going to appeal to everybody, because there's too many of us who believe God loves everyone. You know, if you believe God loves everyone, you can't be a Calvinist.
Yeah, I just can't. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I just can't reconcile, I know this may be simplistic, but I just can't reconcile the Great Commission with the doctrine of predestination. I don't see what impetus there would be for one to fulfill the Great Commission while being under the doctrine of this kind of thing.
Well, for the sake of our listeners who may not know what you're referring to, the Calvinist doctrine is that before any of us were born, God decreed that I would be either saved or not saved, and the same throughout you and everyone else. Each person was born under a divine decree of election or of reprobation. If election, then you will inevitably get saved no matter what. If you are under the decree of reprobation, you cannot get saved no matter what. In other words, God determined before you were born if you could and would get saved or not. If you aren't on his list, then you can't get saved no matter what you do. No matter how much you preach to, no matter how much people persuade you, you can't get saved because you're not elect. But if you are elect, you cannot fail to be saved, because it's God's sovereignty that has determined that you'll be saved, and there's nothing you can do to prevent it. So if that doctrine is true, and that's what Calvinism teaches, then why evangelize? Now, the Calvinist has an answer to that. I don't think it's a good one, but they have one that they always give. And they say that because God doesn't only ordain the ends, he ordains the means as well. And what they mean by that is, if God intended for somebody to become a Christian by me witnessing to them, then they will become a Christian and I will witness to them. It's not just them becoming a Christian that's been sovereignly decreed. It's the means or the method by which they become a Christian. And if I happen to be the one who gets them saved by bringing them to Christ, then God didn't only ordain their salvation, but ordained my involvement. But still, this doesn't give any answer to the person who says, well, what if I just decide I don't want to evangelize anybody? That would simply mean that God has ordained that I don't evangelize anybody. And so the people I would have talked to, he either has ordained for them to get saved through someone else witnessing to them or not to be saved at all. So I might as well just stay home and watch TV. Now, if you ask a serious Calvinist, you know, why should we even evangelize if God has ordained that a certain number of people, and no more, no less, will inevitably be saved, the answer that people like, say, R.C. Sproul will give is that because God commanded it. We evangelize because God commanded it. And, of course, that's not really answering the question properly. Of course we do whatever God commands. If we evangelize, we do it because God commanded it. But the question really should be, why would God command it? If God is going to unilaterally save the elect, can't he do it the way he did it with Paul, have an angel appear to him, or have Jesus appear to him, or an angel come to Cornelius? Or, you know, there's different ways that God could do this directly and has done it before. Why does he have to have Christians go be missionaries to foreign countries and die of diseases that they're not immune to and be martyred and things like that? I mean, why that if God's just going to make it happen anyway? Calvinists would see this kind of reasoning as unenlightened on my part. In fact, they would often say that people like me misunderstand their doctrine. The problem I have with them saying that is I've read their doctrine from their own mouths, trying very hard to understand it. And not just one or two. I've read dozens of Calvinists, and often the most articulate and the most respected Calvinists, and they explain their doctrine. And if I'm still misunderstanding it, either I'm way below average intelligence, or they're not very clear. Or maybe I'm not misunderstanding it. Maybe they're misunderstanding it.
Well, very informative, Steve. Thank you for your answer, and I'll stay a free willer. God bless.
All right, John. God bless you, brother. Good talking to you. All right, we're going to talk next to Scott from Roseville, California. By the way, we have a line open for you. If you want to call, you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call me at 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Scott, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you're broadcasting live today. I thought it was today and tomorrow that you were going to do repeats, which are always your best shows, so those are appreciated.
Well, that was last week. Last week we did recorded shows on Thursday and Friday because it was Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
I figured you'd leave me to the end of the show today. I just had a real quick extension to a previous caller where the Sabbath was discussed, and I was curious if I just simply didn't hear you mention Christ's words about, and I may have reversed this broken brain, I don't want to waste your time on air, so I'm going to try and get this exactly right without looking at my own Bible. Is there a version of Scripture, standard King James or New King James, that does not include the quote by Christ where he says to the people that the Sabbath, men weren't made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for men? Did you mention that?
Yes.
And I did miss it. Darn it. I'm sorry. I need to listen better.
But I made a different point from it than the Seventh-day Adventists usually make. What point would you make from that?
I'm sorry. I struggle. I have to medicate just to listen to your show sometimes for the aneurysm.
Sorry. Then I won't expect anything more from you then. I was wondering what you make of that statement. When Jesus said man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man, Seventh-day Adventists think that Jesus was saying the Sabbath was made for all people, not just Jews, but for mankind. And they think that's the point Jesus was making, which is really a perfect example of people missing the point by not paying attention to the context. If Jesus was saying the Sabbath was for all men, then he should have said the Sabbath was not made for Israel, but the Sabbath was made for mankind. And, by the way, we would expect him in that case to be arguing against somebody who thought that the Sabbath was only for Israel. And that wasn't the position of his critics necessarily. Now, what he's talking about is this. They were using the Sabbath to bully people, to prevent people from eating when they were hungry and from getting their needs met because they were supposed to do nothing on the Sabbath. And Jesus said, listen, this people weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for people. What he means by that is the Sabbath should not be turned into something that afflicts people. It was made for their benefit. Of course, the people it was made for are the Israelites. That's very clear because it says in Exodus that the Sabbath is a sign between God and the Israelites. It wouldn't be if he intended it for other nations too. If all nations were supposed to keep the Sabbath, there'd be no sign, especially of Israel, in keeping it. So it's very clear that it was only for Israel that he gave the Sabbath, and it was not made for Israel to be enslaved by it, but for Israel to be benefited by it. That's what Jesus is saying when he made that particular statement. All right, let's talk next to Norma from Portland, Oregon. Norma, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I kind of have a rebuttal. You always explain Calvinism, and I always think you're explaining it wrong. I think I'm a Calvinist, and I don't like the way you picture them, because I think God knows everything. From the very, very before he ever created the world, he knew who would accept him and who would not, and he works accordingly. Like, my son's not living for the Lord right now, and I pray for him every day. I plead for him every day.
Well, that's good, Norma. Let me jump in here real quickly, because I don't disagree with you. I believe God knows everything, too. I believe he knows who's going to be saved. That's not what Calvinism teaches. Why do you call yourself a Calvinist?
Because I think God knows from the very beginning of time who's going to accept him and who's not going to.
But that's not a Calvinist view. That's that's an Arminian view.
The Calvinist view.
Calvinism.
Oh, well, the way you explain it, like God's going to say who's going to and who's not going to accept
right,
him?
Right, right. Calvinism teaches that God determined who would be saved, and he made that determination quite apart from their own freedom of will, because they don't believe we have free will.
Well,
they
then, believe, then I believe like you do. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, because they believe people are born so enslaved to sin that it's impossible for us to turn to God, and therefore God has to save us first, and then we will believe.
Okay.
And
okay.
The Bible.
I'll listen more carefully. I think I believe more like you do than I thought I did. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I think most people who think they're Calvinists probably do. They just don't understand what Calvinism teaches. Nancy from Walnut Creek, we're almost out of time, but welcome. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
We don't have much time.
Okay, really quickly. I was born and raised a Catholic, and I'm hearing more and more about a faith called Christian Orthodox, commonly known also as Greek Orthodox.
Yeah.
And I've attended a couple of the, you know, the liturgies at church, and it seems to be really, really old school Christian, really, really strict. And I just wanted to get to, I just want to see your opinion. Have you heard of them? What's your suggestion, recommendation?
Yeah, well, let me just jump in here because we're going to run out of time real quick. The Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox or Eastern Orthodox, as they're sometimes called, are a branch off of Western Christianity. They were once joined with the Roman Catholic Church, but in the 11th century they split off. And now they would say it was the Roman Catholic Church that split off from them. The Catholics and the Orthodox have sort of a dispute going because although they split in the 11th century, they both claimed that they were the original church and that the other one split off. But the actions of the Orthodox are very similar to those of the Roman Catholics. They don't have a pope, and they don't necessarily follow the creeds, all the creeds that the Catholics do. But they do have a lot of Roman Catholic seeming like practices because they're very ancient practices that they all practiced together before they split. The Orthodox do not have statues like the Roman Catholics do, but they have what they call icons, which are simply paintings of saints on wooden boards. And this was a very big difference for them. It's hard to believe it would be, but back in the 11th century, there's a huge difference between those who believe they should have icons and those who believe they should have statues. And the Roman, that's one of the big issues that they split over. Not the only one. But so, you know, they have a lot of the same mentality as the Roman Catholic. They don't have the Pope. They have what they call a patriarch. And they don't have quite the same nailed down theological mandates that the Catholics have. I mean, the Roman Catholics will, you know, excommunicate, or at least they used to, excommunicate people for differences on very slight points. I believe the Orthodox are considerably more flexible. But the main thing is that the Orthodox Church and the Catholic, Roman Catholic, both claim to be the original church. I don't believe that either of them are. I believe the original church is a spiritual organization, and I don't believe they had statues, and I don't think the apostles had icons and statues and wore robes and things like that. These kinds of things are traditions of different groups that developed in the centuries after the apostles. But that doesn't mean you can't be a good Christian and be Orthodox too. And if you, you know, are drawn to Orthodox forms of worship, I would not be one to condemn you. I'm not drawn to them myself at all. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. This is the last time you'll hear us this year. And we are listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills and stay on next year, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website and donate from there if you want to. It's thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Happy New Year.